And I've always had a problem with punishment because I actually don't think people, on the whole, change through punishment.
Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, a podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
Hi, our next guest, Charlotte Knight, began her career in the probation service in 1973 and has extensive experience as a probation officer in a range of settings, including both prison and the community. In the second half of her career, Charlotte has been much more involved in working academically to develop probation officers. Her academic work involved setting up a diploma in probation studies and enabling the creation of a degree in criminology at De Montfort University. She completed a PhD in criminology in 2012 on the subject of emotional literacy in criminal justice, and the book that emerged from this is a refreshing read for anyone who's involved with the criminal justice system. Although Charlotte retired from full-time teaching in 2011, she's continued to work on a number of European probation projects and also wrote a second book on LGBT people and the criminal justice system. And Charlotte, we're really delighted to have you here today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Hello, Charlotte. Although you've always been very immersed within the world of probation, your career has taken a number of different turns. Could you talk us through your career?
Yes. I started in social work briefly and did a two-year degree in a two-year certificate in social administration. But while doing my social work qualification at Leicester, I did a probation placement and was completely won over really by the structure and the organisation and the interesting work that probation were doing. So almost immediately I moved to probation and I worked, as you've already said, Naomi, in a number of different probation settings. I spent 2 years at Leicester Prison. I was promoted to senior probation officer and was very lucky to get the job of running the student training unit, which at that time the Home Office sponsored about 20 student training units across the country, very specialised sort of setup, very well resourced. And I was lucky to be able to run that for some years and work with other colleagues nationally really on training students. And I think I learnt a lot of things, but I learned that being a teacher enables you to think very hard about your own practice and the theory underpinning it. Best way to learn anything is to try and teach someone else. So I found that very interesting, and I helped De Montfort University set up its own probation stream. Leicester University already had one, but De Montfort didn't. So I helped them set a stream up, and then 2 years later, I was able to apply for the job of running that probation stream at De Montfort University. So I moved across out of probation, became an academic teacher, and for about 6 years, I worked with the probation stream within a social work context, which was lovely. And then, of course, the government changed the whole structure of probation training and separated it out from social work. So I then had to become involved in setting up the new degree, which was a two-year employment-based distance learning probation degree. And the students were trainees employed by the probation service, and we offered them distance learning programmes. So it was a very intensive, very complex programme to set up and run. But we did that for quite a few years, and I enjoyed that. I had to become manager because our division was growing. We set up a division of community and criminal justice, and I became the division head. And we were running other programs then, including criminology. And I didn't enjoy being a manager so much, and I was able to step aside eventually from that and run a master's program. And as my workload became a little more manageable, that's when I took on the PhD and was able to sort of reflect back on my whole career, really, and think about how important emotions had been to me. When I thought what's the most interesting thing in my career, it actually was the role of emotion within practice and within organisations. And I thought I really want to try and dig below the surface here and think what is it that enables people to work either well or indeed badly. I mean, emotions, negative emotions used badly can be very, very powerful and very damaging. You know, people who manipulate others emotionally can do a lot of damage. So I wanted to look at both sides of it, really. And that's what I did through 6 years of a part-time PhD. And I interviewed a number of experienced sex offender workers, because they were the ones I had seen using their emotions the most carefully and the most usefully, working with very damaged prisoners and probationers who would only open up about their offending if the worker was able to engage with them on an emotional level. And that required a huge amount from the workers. So that's what really grabbed my interest. And I thought, that's what I want to look at. So those are the people I interviewed, sex offender workers and domestic violence workers.
Brilliant. That's fantastic background, Charlotte. I was thinking about your time in the probation service, because we trained at more or less the same time. I trained as a social worker in the sort of beginning of the mid-70s.
Right.
I remember probation officers as being like colleagues in a slightly different office, really. And they had a similar training at Barnet House in Oxford, where I lived. And then later on, I trained as a psychotherapist. And during the 90s, I seemed to have a lot of probation officers coming to see me, and many of them were devastated, really, that their work had changed. Some had lost their jobs. Some felt they'd had their jobs transformed. I wonder if you can tell us a bit about what was going on at that time.
I think the government's view at the time, and not just the government, but most of the government's view, was that social work was not sufficiently geared to challenge offending behaviour, you know, that it was helping offenders. We were helping offenders. That's what probation was set up to do in the 1907 Act, assist, advise and befriend. And I think the view was that this was not challenging their offending behaviour sufficiently. And I do think there's some truth in that. I think certainly I, in my early years, saw myself as a social worker, and my job was to help these young offenders, they were mostly young, to think about managing their lives differently. And offending was there, but it was sort of a bit background. So I think the shift had some positives about it. But of course, what it did is it wrenched it away from all of the good social work qualities of building relationships with young offenders. And it became much more about challenging offending behaviour. That was the most important thing. So I think a lot of my colleagues, and myself included, were very upset about that change. And it took quite a long while to sort of adjust to a different culture. And we became punishment in the community. You know, we were aligned with the prison service. We were seen to be punishing people rather than helping them. And I've always had a problem with punishment, because I actually don't think people, on the whole, change through punishment. Some do, but I think an awful lot of people actually only really change when their own needs are addressed and they are helped to see the damage that they've caused to others. And for me, that's achieved through very careful, well, you'll know this, careful, thoughtful, challenging interventions. So, yes, I think probation lost a lot during that period. I think a lot of damage was done to it. But to be honest, I think more damage was done by the subsequent privatisation, when the government sold off a huge chunk of the probation service to the private sector. I think even more damage was done then. So it became a service I couldn't recognise. I mean, it is now, of course, some of it's being renationalised again, isn't it? And we maybe don't want to spend too long talking about the politics of it, but the privatisation agenda completely threw a brick right through all the work that probation had gradually begun to really develop, good work around building relationships and challenging offending behaviour. That sort of went out the window for a while, I think, and we're having to try and claw it back again. I don't know whether that says enough, really. It was a difficult time, two difficult times, really.
Yeah, I think that's very helpful, Charlotte, because I think what I'm hearing from you is that some development was certainly needed in the within the probation service in terms of focus of the work, but that the transformation that took place was, in the end, fairly unhelpful.
Well, the final transformation agenda was, I think when we set up the Diploma in Probation Studies, those of us who had a background in social work worked very hard to make sure these trainees did learn about, you know, building relationships and getting alongside offenders and being aware of issues of diversity. We had to pack all of that into a two-year degree programme, but we did work very hard at that. And I think some of the early cohorts coming out of that Diploma in Probation Studies were very skilled workers, you know, so I wouldn't want to say that didn't work well. But over the years since then, it's been eroded, you know, it's been changed and adapted and cut down. And then the final transformation agenda of moving it out to the private sector, I think, is what did the most damage, really. And of course, I was no longer involved by that time. I was about retiring when that happened. So fortunately for me.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I think that notion of probation becoming a form of punishment at that point is quite timely here in the conversation, because the reason we came to invite you on was because we had a conversation with a former guest, Professor Rob Canton, who wrote about, written a lot about punishment, and he described you as hugely influential and inspiring. And I suppose the thing that really stood out from your work was this focus on emotional literacy, which I'm guessing you were interested in long before you completed a PhD in the subject. And I wondered if you could describe what you mean by the term emotional literacy. Are you talking about emotional intelligence?
Not quite. I think there are some disputes about the differences or the similarities between the two. It was Susie Orbach's book. She wrote a book on, as a psychoanalyst, she wrote a book on emotional literacy, and that's what got me really interested. And she talked about it in relation to politics and other difficult areas, where she said, for example, politicians, if they were emotionally literate, would be much more able to convey their message. I mean, emotional intelligence was mostly being thought about in business and in management. And I thought, I want to look at emotional literacy, which for me was about using skills to engage with someone. And it also wasn't about measuring. I don't think you can measure emotional literacy. I don't think you can measure emotional intelligence either. But I mean, I expect you know that there's five key areas. It's self-awareness, being aware of your own emotions, self-regulation, being able to regulate your own emotions. Motivation, so you get energy and motivation from your emotions to engage. Empathy, of course, absolutely crucial, being able to stand in someone else's shoes. And being socially competent. Those are the five normally seen as key areas of social emotional literacy. I mean, I added to them in my PhD because I also thought the organisational context was really important, where people were operating within. That impacted hugely on people's ability to be emotionally literate. And also gender became for me a very significant element in it as well. So I sort of looked at those two additional elements of emotional literacy through my PhD. But other people use the term emotional intelligence. Sometimes it's seen as interchangeable. People talk about emotional labour as well, and how that can sometimes become a bit seen as similar. I don't think they are quite the same.
But I think those two things about the organisation and also the gender differences as well are both quite interesting themes which you explore in your book. I wondered if you could say a little bit about the organisation. I mean, emotional literacy seems to be something that's been quite neglected within the criminal justice system.
I think it has been actively suppressed, to be honest. The history of criminology is that it was introduced as a science, so that people doing criminology, who were mostly men, wanted to do large-scale randomised trials, you know, so that they could produce scientific evidence of crime and criminality. They could produce objective facts about crime. And, I mean, there was a lot of good stuff coming out of that. But what was completely suppressed, if you like, was the much more subjective emotional elements of crime. And it was only when, I have to say, when women became involved in criminology back in about 1970s, some of the feminist criminologists who started to say, hang on, this isn't the whole picture. You know, you're talking about men, you're studying men, you yourselves are men. What about women? You know, you can't just translate what you've learned across to women and assume it's the same. So they started to recognise the need for doing much more engaged research with women, a much more subjectively orientated research, what they call standpoint research, I think. Understanding the lived experiences of women. And through that, of course, the whole areas of child abuse and domestic violence and sexual violence became much more evident. I mean, it'd always been there, but it wasn't being picked up because people weren't being asked the right questions. So I think women had to fight quite a hard battle to get it into criminology. And I think similarly, criminal justice has always been seen as somehow an objective, I don't know quite what the words are, but, you know, we're rightly proud of our criminal justice system in the UK in lots of ways, that we treat people fairly and justly. But I think that's sometimes meant to the exclusion of understanding all the emotional undercurrents and issues. So, you know, hard, rational, reasonable decisions are one thing, but what about all the softer sort of emotional undercurrents that are going on? And I think emotional literacy allows people to do both, you know, to acknowledge the importance of emotion, to recognise it, to talk about it, to actually feel it on occasions in the right place, and then to make good decisions on the basis of both the evidence that they've got that's factual and the evidence they've got that's much more subjective.
I think that's a really interesting point about sort of feminist criminologists getting involved and wanting to look differently at women who are in prison, because I think the notion that people in prison have long histories of kind of like trauma and adversity during childhood, that's much more well developed as a conversation when it comes to talking about female prisoners. But my experience is that men in prison have very similar which I don't think will surprise you, have very similar backgrounds, and really don't see any difference in the kind of life events that people have experienced, whether they be men or women. But it's much more palatable to talk about it when we're talking about women in prison than when we're talking about men in prison.
It's a shame in a way, isn't it, that I've often thought we should turn it on its head and say, what can we learn from women that will help us work with men? I mean, it's men who commit crime by and large, isn't it? The vast percentage of people in prison are male, and the vast number of crimes are committed by men. So what is it about women that they don't commit crime? You know, what can we turn it on its head? But emotion is still, I think, seen as a weakness, as a sort of a less important issue. You know, it's somehow, the people I talked to said it's the underground work we do. It's invisible. We are silenced from talking about it. It's not seen as an acceptable subject for discussion in team meetings. And I mean, this was a few years ago, and I'd like to think it's changed a bit, but I think it's still there somehow.
It's interesting you say that, because the project that I work in, where there's a lot of discussion around emotions and the use of so-called soft skills to de-escalate situations rather than taking people to segregation, the officers get referred to by officers in the other part of the prison's care bears in a kind of like disparaging way. I mean, that has diminished a bit over time, but it's still seen as being the work on our unit and our service is not as hard as the work anywhere else, even though the majority of the people within our service have come directly from segregation or CSEs and are actually much more challenging. They haven't been able to live on normal location because they've posed a management problem to the prison system. But I wondered, do you think that sense that the work isn't valued is a direct consequence of it seeing emotional literacy and that being seen to be something that's more closely tied up with being feminine than masculine?
I know, I'm just rereading the stuff I wrote in the book on LGBT people in criminal justice about prisons being very sort of heteronormative and the masculinity being such a powerful thing. And I think that's true for the staff as well, isn't it, really? That somehow this need to be seen as tough and masculine is very important. And I think I said to you, Naomi, I called my PhD Soft Skills for Hard Work, because I thought, actually, the work that these sex offenders, and I'm sure you too, are doing, is actually much, much harder than just being a rather tough, shouty disciplinarian. It's much harder to engage emotionally with someone who's very damaged and who's got tremendously difficult needs and problems. Much harder work. But that isn't what's conveyed to the outside world, is it? That is invisible. That's not seen. What's seen is the toughness, you know, and that's what the government picks up on, being tough on crime and tough on offenders and being punitive. And it's a very powerful agenda that the government still pushes all the time, doesn't it?
Absolutely, and but also seems to be to some degree what the public clamour for. And I think you also touched on something really important there about sort of visibility of LGBT people in prison. And I think that is something that does need to be spoken about more. I think we probably need to do a full podcast on that theme rather than consign it to a part of a conversation today. But I just wanted to acknowledge that you'd raised that, because actually I think, you know, it's incredible that there's so few. Certainly, I think gay men who are out as gay men working within the prison system, whereas being lesbian seems to be much more palatable.
When we did some work with the police, we were told that there was almost no out gay policemen. You know, there were quite a lot of out lesbian police women, but the men completely kept below the radar. It wasn't safe enough for them to be out. So it's the same sort of issue. But I appreciate we won't talk about further about that. But it's just part of it, isn't it? It's part of the invisibility of these sort of issues.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it'd be good to perhaps have you back on again another time to talk about that theme. But rather than, I don't want to make it a small part of a bigger discussion, because it does seem to be really important. One of the things that I really liked about your book is the attention that you pay to the emotional literacy of the staff in the criminal justice system, because generally, I think when there's discussion about interventions focused on reducing risk, it's always been about they're aimed at the people who are imprisoned or people that are under the auspices of the criminal justice system. But I suppose your reflection suggests that enhancing the emotional literacy of staff in the system would be equally as impactful.
Well, in a way, that is what my focus was. It was staff rather than offenders, yes, because I saw that was the best route in. And if you want to help offenders in any shape or form, you need staff who are themselves emotionally literate. And I think that's true across the criminal justice sector. I mean, I didn't interview police, but I have a nephew who was a police inspector, and he and I talked a lot about it. And he was able to see that a police officer who was emotionally shut down was not going to get the same information from a vulnerable witness or a vulnerable offender as a police officer who had emotional awareness and could ask the right questions and instead of being confronting and aggressive, was able to listen, just properly listen to what the person was saying. So that made me think, yes, it was useful for all across the whole sector. You might not expect police to be sort of therapeutic or in a counselling role, but they still needed to be able to listen, and they needed to be able to keep their own emotions to one side while they listened to probably some pretty horrific stuff. I mean, police do have to deal with some horrific stuff, don't they? And if they're completely unemotionally aware,
absolutely,
I suspect some of them are going to find that really hard. I'm sure they do.
And I think really that's how you and I came to this, David, in some ways, isn't it? That we were interested in how people preserve their emotional well-being and resilience, their emotional literacy. And I think probably that's a feature of the people that have guested on this podcast has been people where emotional literacy is something that they've valued in themselves, or it's all been a characteristic of their personalities, I would say, wouldn't you, David?
Yeah, but you see, I'm thinking as we're going along about the personal transformation that people go through in the duration of their work career. So, and I was remembering a woman I used to work with for quite a long while. I worked with a police counselling service, and she was a very bright woman, police sergeant, who really identified with the machismo of the police force. So everything that you've just been talking about, she kind of bought into, and that made her a very powerful and effective police officer. And then she went off on maternity leave, and when she came back, she found she couldn't do the job anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, she couldn't really join in. She couldn't see herself driving up the road at 80 miles an hour as she used to do, chasing people. Yeah, because clearly, and she hadn't thought this through. It wasn't something that she'd conceptualize. It was just the effects of this life-transforming event. Anyway, I don't quite know where that fits into what you were saying. It just came to mind while you were talking.
One of the questions that you had written down to me was that can people learn it? And I think yes, they can. I think you probably do have to have some sort of emotional availability as well. But I think sometimes these life changes do have that impact on people, don't they? They either get completely burnt out and leave the service, or they shut down their emotions. We might want to come back to that. Some people manage by just shutting down their feelings in order to do the job, or they get burnt out, or they think, actually, I need to do something about this. I need to either change my job or go into counselling and think harder about why I'm finding this difficult. And I suppose the people who do that on the whole are the ones who become the most literate, probably, ultimately, aren't they? Going through their own personal, whether it's trauma or transition or change in life, getting help, verbalising, being able to talk about what's going on, that's the biggest issue. A lot of men never learn the language, do they? The emotional vocabulary. One of my interviewees, he was a domestic violence worker, and he said, I say to these men, you know, how will you feel? How did you feel when this happened? And they say, I felt gutted. He said, all they ever say is, I feel gutted. He said, they haven't got any other words for how they feel. And he thought he had to teach them a whole new language of emotional words so that they could be, other than just feeling gutted, they could really start thinking about, you know, the shame or the humiliation or the fear that they actually felt rather than just being gutted, you know. So...
Yeah, I trained in a body focused therapy in the last decade, and I thought I was quite good at talking about emotions. And then actually, when you're having to really kind of like get into the nitty gritty of describing what you're feeling inside, I was shocked by how impoverished my vocabulary seemed for the task.
I interviewed 28 people in the end for my research in some depth, and almost all of them, I would say to them quite early on, I'd say to them, What does emotion mean? And they'd look at me and they'd say, I don't know. And, you know, I'd sort of hold it with them there while they sort of started to think about it. And they'd say, you know, I've never really been asked that, or I've never actually had to think about it. I asked my offenders how they feel, but now you're asking me, I don't know. And it's exactly that. They hadn't really been enabled in the work context to think about emotion and find words for it and reflect on it. So actually I think they quite often quite enjoyed the research interviews, you know, because of that. It was a space where they could start thinking about it.
And you also make reference to Simon Baron Cohen's work and how he'd identified, was it something like 1500 emotions or something? Exactly. Which I just thought, oh my goodness, I could, to even begin to catalogue those.
Yes, there are a lot. But one of the things I did find again through my research was that when I asked them to specify, to actually talk about the feelings they had at work, there was a much greater preponderance of negative emotion over positive. And when I started to highlight that, it was quite a shock, really. And I don't think they were very happy about it, but the truth was a lot of the feelings they had were negative ones, arising not just from the work, but from the organisation, the way they felt the organisation was not supporting them well enough. Most of it actually was to do with the organisation. The positive emotions came from building good relationships with offenders and feeling that they were making a difference. That was positive and they felt good about that, but they mostly felt pretty angry and pretty frustrated with their organisation.
Yeah, you reminded me again of something. The last place I worked at Gartree Prison was a small unit for men with learning difficulties. And we had to spend a lot of time working with the residents of this small unit, thinking about emotion, what is meant by emotion. Of course, their vocabulary was very limited in just the kind of way that you're describing. So they were familiar with anger, and they were familiar with humiliation and embarrassment, which all, of course, trigger rage and anger, ultimately.
Yeah.
But it seems to me as if there are some emotions, like being angry with people, which are somehow much more acceptable or recognisable within the criminal justice system, whereas other emotions are much less frequently spoken of. Sadness, shame, love, humiliation and... things like that. So this must have a pretty big impact on those who live and work in those circumstances.
I'm sure it does. I think that anger is an emotion that men are allowed to feel, isn't it? I mean, it's okay for men to be angry, whereas it's not okay on the whole for men to be vulnerable or to admit to feeling some of these other feelings. Women, I think, are more, I mean, these are generalisations, but women are more inclined to suppress their own anger, I think, and be more willing to admit to things like fear and embarrassment. And I think one of the things I've found both through my own personal explorations and through my research was that anger often hides fear, doesn't it? That often that the underlying emotion is fear, and mostly it's men, I mean, some women as well, but will be angry rather than actually want to face the fact that they're probably quite terrified underneath for all sorts of different reasons. And it's that's the one that's very hard to get to initially. I mean, not many men are going to want to admit that, are they? Or indeed women.
I think it's often the fear of humiliation and emotional collapse.
Absolutely, yes, it is. But somehow you think you'll just lose control completely if you acknowledge what you're really feeling. But I mean, I sat through meetings with, I have to say, historically in the probation service when women were a minority, with a lot of very angry men arguing with each other all the time, but they would never say they were being emotional. You know, they would dominate the agenda, they'd silence all the rest of us. But this was legitimate, you know, they were cross and that, and they were going to make sure everybody knew about it. So, you know, it's sort of an legitimising of some emotion and, as you said, suppression and a delegitimising of other, probably more profound emotions, really.
So there are two key points, I think, arising from this, Charlotte. Is it possible to increase one's emotional literacy, and do we associate an improvement in emotional literacy with well-being? Does it make us feel better?
Yeah, that's a difficult one, isn't it? I think we can improve our emotional literacy. The workers I think who were the most emotionally literate, my judgment of them when they talked with me, on the whole were ones who'd been in counselling and who valued counselling and saw it as the way that they had themselves become much more emotionally literate. But whether it enhances your well-being, I didn't look at that specifically, so I think I could only offer an opinion. I couldn't offer you any research evidence on that. But my opinion is that, yes, I think it does, because I think it means you look after yourself better when you have a better understanding of what the triggers are that maybe make you feel upset, or particular interviews or particular offenders or particular managers who trigger emotions in you. If you are aware of that, I think you're more able to develop strategies and systems to support yourself, and you're more able to articulate it and say, this is what's going on, I need some help here. And I think on the whole, that's likely to lead to a better sense of well-being in your life. You're more likely to take time out, you recognise you need a break, you need to take some leave, you need some counselling. I think all of those things are, in my opinion, are likely to lead to get a better work-life balance. I think it's people who shut down on their emotions or who repress them who are probably more likely to either burn out or, I don't know. I mean, that's a bit of a judgment. That's my opinion anyway, yes, I think you.
Well, I think it's quite related to authenticity, isn't it? And authenticity is supposed to be related to well-being. And I suppose all emotions do have an action potential associated with them, don't they, in terms of, you know, anger being about, supposed to be being about protection, and sadness about eliciting comfort. And I suppose if you're emotionally literate and are able to talk about what's really expressed, what's really going on for you, it does mean that the emotion gets played out in its true sense. Rather, I suppose you kind of see people that struggle to talk about their emotions or express them in a true way, and worry about how that then gets taken home and acted out in terms of irritability, yes, or, you know, having to use strategies to suppress it further.
Yes. Yes, which takes a lot of energy. Again, it's a bit like people who stay in the closet, lesbian and gay people who stay in the closet, use all their emotional energy concealing and hiding and keeping it suppressed. When they're able to come out and be authentic, as you're saying, they're generally much happier, much more sort of, their well-being is enhanced hugely when they can really be themselves and talk about things. So, yes, again, another link there.
It must be much less tiring, I think, if you can just be your authentic self rather than having to pretend or mask stuff.
I think that's right. And I think the experienced workers that I talked to would say things like how they'd sat through a really difficult interview with somebody who was expressing some really worrying information about their behaviour and their fantasies and what they were thinking of doing to children or adults. They come out of that interview feeling completely sort of, oh, wow. But they knew they had to do something about that. So they'd either find a colleague or they'd ask for a debriefing session or they'd have a counselling session where they could just go, whoosh, this was awful. You know, I felt terrible afterwards. They could let the emotion out and then they could go back to that same offender a week later and sort of gird themselves up again and be able to deal with it again in an emotionally careful way because they'd had the debrief, they'd had the chance to. Whereas if they never did that, I think that you store stuff up, don't you? You know, you store up all these awful things that you've been hearing and it's bound to affect you. It's bound to have an impact on your ability to function properly, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose another thought that I had when reading your book, Charlotte, was, which, by the way, I would recommend that anybody who works in the criminal justice system ought to be reading. And in fact, you use the phrase moral endeavour. You suggest that emotional literacy is a moral endeavour, that people should be seeking to be emotionally literate. Yeah. But it really made me think about treatment. And I think too often the system kind of becomes focused on specific interventions. Yeah. When I think probably what we all know is it's not so much the specific intervention, but it's the way in which that's delivered. So the emotional literacy, the staff in the service that are delivering the intervention rather than the intervention itself. And in places like therapeutic communities where David's worked, and places like the FEMS unit where I work, it's we recognise that it's not the formal therapy that works, but the creation of a safe environment where one can be authentic. I wondered how do you go about doing this within a community setting where you might be the only contact?
You mean creating a safe space for the worker or for the offender, or both?
Well, both, I guess. I suppose the two are kind of related, aren't they?
Mm, they are. Well, again, it comes down to, I think, the organisational structures. I think I've talked about in the book about building emotional resources within an organisation in the way that you talk about social capital. I think there is such a thing as emotional capital as well, that you can build that within an organisation, but it needs to be from the top right the way down. It's not sufficient to just somehow expect your workers to do it quietly in a office somewhere. Mm-hmm. I think it needs formalising so that there are opportunities for things like debriefing straight after you've done a really difficult interview or run a really complex group work programme. And I think they do have debriefing. Most probation services do, I think, for things like sex offender group work. But there should always be debriefing. There should be opportunities for mentoring so that staff maybe have a mentor that they... And that doesn't mean that they're inexperienced, but they still have somebody they can go to talk through. Because not all staff want to be seen to be in counselling. Again, counselling can have a bit of a negative, you know, she needs counselling because she's got a problem, rather than everybody needs a counselling opportunity. Mentoring is somehow a slightly more neutral word, and I think it allows staff to go and feel they can offload to a mentor. I think it needs to be on agendas in all meetings, somehow or other, the opportunity to talk about feelings. I think senior staff need to be aware of its significance so that they encourage it to be on agendas and to be thought about. It takes more time, of course, but I think it's time well spent. So instead of just a tick box of, like, have we done this? Have we ticked off all the people who should have been at this group? Have we ticked off all our targets? We actually have a space where people can say, well, actually, you know, I'm not feeling too good this week because of A, B and C. Can we look at how we might shift some of our priorities? So, I mean, I'm not sure you can ever create a completely safe space, can you? I'm not sure there is such a thing as a completely safe space, because my safe space might not be somebody else's. I mean, if you're working with a black offender or a black colleague, my safe space as a white worker might not feel safe to the black colleague. So I'm not sure you can promise people safe spaces, but I think you have to do whatever you can to enable people to feel they can speak out, that they can talk and not silence them, whatever that means for them.
Yeah, something about prioritising emotional safety, isn't there, as part of the work. And you suggested that there is this kind of like pressure for staff that work in the criminal justice sector to operate from an emotionally neutral position. Do you think that's even possible?
No, I don't think it is. But do you know about Hochschild's work on feeling rules in organisations? She did a lot of work on. She started looking at airline staff, how they had to be always nice and supportive to the passengers, but as soon as they got back to the galley, they would offload. But the feeling rules of the organisation were to be nice. It's such a McDonald's, isn't it? You smile at people, you're nice to them, you know. So the feeling rules tell you how you should behave. And I think the feeling rules of quite a lot of criminal justice organisations are be professional, you know, be calm, be neutral. That's the right way to behave. And some people feel they have to buy into that. And actually, I think the feeling rules ought to be about emotional engagement, you know, being able to engage with people emotionally. Doesn't mean you go around crying all the time. I mean, we might if it was that bad, but I think people misunderstand emotional engagement and think that means you have to be emotional. And it isn't about that, is it? It's about acknowledging emotions when they are critical. Maybe having a space to feel what you're feeling, but then to come back and be much more sort of engaged and able to manage the situation because you haven't denied the emotional content.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, we leak it in so many ways, don't we? I always find it interesting. I've referred to this before, but we, you know, people that work for the prison service are expected to write reports and refer to Mr. such and such rather than use their first name so that it doesn't sound too familiar. Mm. And yet you can read that report and that you can tell straight away whether the author of the report really liked the person that they were working with or really disliked them. And sometimes the contempt just oozes out of the report. And other times they clearly felt sad and were able to see the more vulnerable part of the person. But, you know, to me, it just seems nonsense that people don't bring their emotional selves to work, no matter how hard people try.
Yeah, I've given one or two examples in the book, I think, of where I think probation staff have been negative. You know, they've written fairly negative pre-sentence reports because the offender perhaps hasn't turned up or he's turned up late or he's been uncooperative. And it comes through in the report, you know, we can't help this person sort of thing. And of course, the emotions come through all the time. And the ones who aren't aware of it, they can be quite judgmental. Because they didn't like the person or they didn't feel they were being suitably cooperative, you know. And yes, it can come out in a very negative way, quite a punitive way. In fact, we use our emotions punitively. And I think that can happen quite often in any criminal justice setting, including probation. So that's why it's so important to be aware of your emotions. And yeah, you're not always going to like everybody, are you? But you need to think, well, what does that mean for this person? In this, I don't like them. Should I transfer the case to somebody else? Should I go and think about why I don't like them? You know, what is it being triggered in me that's making me feel this? It's all of that which gets sort of swept under the carpet, doesn't it, in a lot of cases?
Yeah, and denies opportunities for growth, doesn't it, as well? Whether that be the growth in the worker to understand what it is about the individual, or maybe there'd be feedback to the person they're working with, you know, about why they're having such a strong reaction to them that might actually help them, you know, if somebody really dislikes somebody, then it suggests that might be a reaction that other people also have.
So it sounds as if creating an atmosphere and a culture whereby these things can be talked about and thought about rather than just left, really. Because I was thinking, I mean, often I've been in the presence of colleagues who have said really unpleasant things about residents, and I always have the dilemma, do I challenge this and embarrass and humiliate this person, or do I just let it ride? And of course the real issue is, how can I get it talked about? And that's always, I find, quite a challenge.
I think it is
such a good point,
because people can be extremely defensive, can't they, if you do try and challenge it.
So Charlotte, what What do you think, you've touched upon this to some extent already, but what do you think needs to change to enable the system to be more emotionally literate and more supportive of emotionally literate staff?
And that nice simple question.
Well, I don't know. More women in leadership roles is one sort of top of the head thought. I mean, I wouldn't for a minute say that men can't be emotionally literate, but I think women are more likely to be. So there's a role model that, for example, Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand gives is of an emotionally literate politician, isn't it? And I mean, she seems to be well respected and well regarded, and she's emotionally literate. And even if you were to compare, heaven forbid, Nicola Sturgeon and Boris Johnson, I think Nicola Sturgeon is, I wouldn't say she was highly emotionally literate, but she has engaged better with the public through this pandemic than Johnson ever has, because she said things like, I'm sorry, you know, and I understand that you're upset, and I wish I had done things differently. She says these things, she acknowledges stuff. Or Johnson just blusters all the way through and completely denies any emotional content. So I think probably more role models, and I have to say, I think probably more female, strong female role models would be one thing that would make the most difference. And the criminal justice system is still really dominated by men. Most judges are men, aren't they? Most politicians, legislators are still men. Most police chiefs are still men. I don't think that's the only answer, but that's the one that comes to my mind first.
And something about the qualities which those particular women demonstrate. I can think of other women who haven't had those qualities.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
Also,
a lot of women at the top have had to emulate the male sort of toughness, a bit like the woman inspector you were telling me about, David. They feel they have to emulate that hard-nosed, tough, masculine sort of approach, because that's the only way they can survive in that situation. So I wonder how people like Jacinda Ardern survive, you know, where she gets her support from, how she builds a team around her that are sort of critical friends, I suppose, the sort of friends who will get alongside you and be supportive, but can also say the hard things that you need to hear. But you can hear them because you trust them and you believe what they're saying is in your best interests and everybody else's best interests. So having good, strong, critical friends around you, I think, is important in an organisation. You don't just surround yourself with people who will just say yes to you, you know. With your trunk, you just sack everybody, don't you? But
repeatedly. So you what you're suggesting is that ideally there'd be somebody with the kind of qualities you're describing who's then able to create a circle of critical friends, as you put it, who can be honest, but honest in a very supportive manner. Mm. And that might be a kind of pattern for building a culture throughout an organisation.
Yes, I mean, some of the circles of support that are used to support sex offenders do that, don't they, in the community. It's a sort of a circle of critical friends around a sex offender that enables, I think, probably the best hope of changing their behaviour. But in leadership, I think the same thing should apply, yes.
Great. Are you very optimistic about this kind of development spreading?
I'd like to say yes. I think there is evidence that there are more men are beginning to become more, you know, more men are being more open about being parents, aren't they? And about being more vulnerable in that way. I think that more that young men can start to see that it's okay to be, to enjoy these softer skills of parenting and being emotional, then when I think in that way, I feel more optimistic, yes. When I think about the current sort of populism that we seem to be overrun by and some of the governments that we have, I feel very pessimistic. So it depends what, I suppose, what I'm thinking about on the day, really. I'd like to be more optimistic. Yeah, I think things have developed. I think a lot of the movements that are going on at the moment, the Me Too movement and the Black Lives Matter movement, are about young people saying, yeah, but we matter, you know, and listen to us and listen to what we're saying and be open to hearing what we're saying. I feel very positive when I think about that. Yeah, perhaps I should end on that note rather than on...
Well, I think that is quite positive, really, because it seems to me that what we need to find out is how to counter the overriding themes of demagoguery or populism. And perhaps it is particularism, picking particular areas to develop campaigns around. That's the way forwards.
And the work that, Naomi, you were telling me about, you know, the five-year programme of working with offenders and dealing with their emotional needs first, I was so pleased to hear that. I mean, that seems to me exactly the right thing, that people will only learn and change when their own needs have been initially attended to. So, yes, I mean, when I hear those, hear what you're doing, I do feel optimistic, yeah.
So finally, we're also really interested in understanding how the people that we meet with for these conversations have managed to keep themselves healthy and wholesome and maintain their own resilience despite kind of like many years of working in the criminal justice sector. And I was wondering what you see as the key to having retained your own emotional literacy and not disconnecting from your own emotions at work. How have you kept yourself nourished?
Probably mostly through building positive relationships. I think, you know, having strong, supportive colleagues that I could talk to. I did myself was in counselling for a long time, and that certainly helped me a lot. But I think the work-life balance is also critical, really, so that I've tried to always maintain another life other than work. That's why I'm enjoying my retirement so much now, because I'm doing things I want to do all the time. Because I think work in criminal justice is very challenging, very demanding work for anybody, really. And I think the only way to survive it really is to find other things in your life that nourish you, you know, that support you and sustain you. And for me, being outside, and I'm a volunteer with the Canal and River Trust, which is so far removed from what I did before, but it's lovely. And I think, you know, you need these things in your life as well. And I tried to hold on to those things in my own life while I was still working, you know.
Thank you. That was such a lovely conversation. Really enjoyed that, Charlotte.
Well, I did too. Thank you. It's really nice to meet you two and to know what you're doing. It's very encouraging for me.
That was great, Charlotte.
So I feel really lucky that we've had these conversations with, I think, firstly Gerard Drennan and then Rob Canton and now Charlotte Knight, where this theme of emotional literacy has become really salient, and feel lucky that we've been managing to stick with this theme over a few weeks. I think one of the things that really stood out for me from Charlotte's conversation was that the idea that organisations need to be building up emotional capital and leading from the top down and thinking much more about intervening directly with staff in terms of the staff emotional literacy, not just the way that we usually think within the system about the people who are living there that are identified as needing help, needing the intervention. I think what Charlotte was offering was really quite a different, more an innovative way of approaching the problem.
Yeah, I agree. I think what I was thinking was similar in a way, that I really like the way in which we've been talking with some expert practitioners who've then applied their time to thinking about the work that they do. And in Charlotte's case, of course, advocating that time is put aside in organisations to think about things. And I can remember when I first started to work in the prison service, what I thought was there wasn't any thinking taking place, that things always happened by reaction. And it was just like talking with some of the guys that we were working with, that they always thought they were thinking, but actually they were responding quickly to kind of emotional drives, which is quite a different sort of process. And apart from that, I thought Charlotte was, I mean, she was an amazing example of being able to sum up things in a few words. Like she said, most people don't change with punishment. It's so obvious, but to have it contained there in that precise sentence was wonderful, I thought. Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage, lockeduplives.com, and our Twitter account, Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.